Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us here on Human Rights Demand. This is the Leona Brando Show. Hello, Leona. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Mary?
Very well, thank you. I'll turn it over to you now.
I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
We have a special guest on with us today.
I wish I could say.
Her name is Laura Griffin.
And I should say.
She's going to be talking to us
about the
foundation she has started.
Hello?
Okay, we have Laura Griffin on the phone with us today, and she's going to be speaking about a program that she has started, a foundation to help the troubled adolescent, female adolescents. And she also is going to be talking about her fiancé, who was in prison as a teenager and will soon be released, and who has also written a book. And Laura, we want to thank you for being on the show with us, and we'd like to have you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, my name is Laura Griffin Smith, and I am from New Jersey. I presently live in Arizona, and it's not my fiancé, he is my husband.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And presently, I'm opening up, I have a master's in human services, been in recovery for 25 years. I'm presently opening up emergency crisis shelter for girls here in Yuma, Arizona, which is like 45 minutes from California. And this emergency crisis shelter will service young ladies ages 13 to 17, and we will be able to help them do youth development, entrepreneurship, job readiness, and keep them in their counties and go to their schools. So this is the first crisis shelter for girls here in Yuma. And so this initiative, our grand opening is September the 8th, and we had the honor of having Antoine Fisher come and do our ribbon cutting. So we're excited about this new initiative that is called Kids at Hope is what we're working on, that every kid can succeed with no exception. So that's one of the projects that I'm working on through my nonprofit, which is called Rafa Inc.
How
and we started
that,
this.
Laura, how do you spell the name of your program? Your
R-A-F-H-A. Our website is R-A-F-H-A.
And what is the second word?
R-A-F-H-A.
Oh, S as in Sam.
S as in Frank.
Oh, okay.
H as in Harry. Yeah. R as in Ralph, A as in Apple, F as in Frank, H as in Harry, A as in Apple.
Okay, and is that the name of it? Is the Rafa Foundation?
Rafa Inc. is our organization.
Oh, Rafa Inc. Okay, that's what I needed to know. I knew there was something more to it. And the website?
The website is www.ceyw.org, and that stands for the Center for Empowering Young Women.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Very good.
So that's one of them.
Can I ask one quick question? Is this for just the Arizona area?
Right now, we're just for the Arizona area, and anywhere in Arizona right now. We deal with some of the natives, which is in Winter Haven, California. So right now we would just deal with, you know, the people that's really close to us, because right now our girls go to Phoenix, Tucson, Parker, and when they are in crises, that's where they have to go, which is like 3 hours away from us.
Wow.
And
you
then
do
they
plan
pay for a cab
to expand.
Yeah. So if a young lady goes to Phoenix, Tucson, or Parker, then they pay for a cab, $600 up and $600 back for that girl to come back in town and visit her family. So they're paying $1,200 every 2 weeks for her to visit her family, which is just really not cost effective.
No, very, very inappropriate.
Right. So that's a great initiative that's happening. The other movement that myself and my husband has created, which is Voiceless Publication. My husband was incarcerated at the age of 15. He was caught with a charge of attempted murder. They gave him 30 years. And he is a candidate of the new law here, bill in California, which is the SB 260. And he is eligible for that bill. Any teenager that have been incarcerated under the age of 15, under the age of 18, they were immature to stand trial. So he is eligible for that bill, and his parole hearing will be in January. So we're really excited about that, because if this bill has not passed and went through, he wouldn't have been eligible for another 2 years.
Now, how long has he been in now, Laura?
18 years.
18. I firmly believe that in a case like that, I think that they should have that opportunity. I don't believe anyone should be serving life sentences without the possibility of ever getting out, especially those who have gone in as teenagers. And I'm sure, and I know that you'll be discussing possibly the book that he's written, but especially when they have gone into prison and they've done so well while incarcerated and actually were able to do a lot of things that even people on the outside haven't been able to accomplish. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yes, the book is called Voiceless, and it's actually several poems that he wrote because he was in Pelican Bay and different parts of California prison system. So the book is about poems, of very dark poems, some of them, and some of them are things that he experienced throughout his time. So it's all poems, and then he explained each poem that he wrote. He does an explanation of each poem. So the book is Voiceless, and it talks about just him and his experiences and where his mindset was throughout the 18 years.
Is there anywhere, do you have it online now where people can actually go to a website to order the book?
Yes, you can go to Amazon.com and get a Kindle version of it. I think it's like $3.99.
Okay, that would be under his name, Shannon
Smith? Shannon, Smith.
Okay. So you mentioned that he wrote a lot of poems about the experiences that he's gone through while incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those, and I don't know, recently there's been a lot of discussion about the Ferguson, Missouri shooting of Michael Brown. And actually, it's really ignited a lot of the issues that the black males have had to endure at the hands of law enforcement and also with guards and prison officials throughout the years. Those poems that he's written, those were a lot of the things that he's gone through in the last 18 years that he's been incarcerated?
Yes.
And what would some of those abuses or deprivations, provocations, or whatever they may be, what were some of them that he was able to actually mention in his book?
Well, he mentioned, he has one called The Pen and the Sword, and that talks about a lot about, you know, how, you know, he needed to, deal with, sometimes you got to write things on paper, you know, and use it as your leverage. He talked about harsh, how the whole system made him harsh because of the disrespect and the inappropriate things that he had to encounter, you know, throughout that time. Another one was talking about, which is a gift and a curse. You know, sometimes we do have gifts and we do have curse, but he just really, really gets into talking about, his internal struggles, some of the things he did, you know, as far as the wasted youth and how he felt like, you know, his whole youth was wasted, you know, being in them wires, you know, of and being in them concrete walls and the treatment that he has felt, you know, throughout it. He talks about a lot of that unfairness and you know, the whole, you know, degradation.
Yeah. It's really a shame that so many people have to go through these things when they're incarcerated. I've always thought of the Department of Corrections across the country as being a place where people would go in for maybe a crime they committed, but at the same time they would be rehabilitated. And
right.
I really think that, and I say this all the time, that I really believe there needs to be more programs on the outside, preventative programs such as the one you have. And yours is for young female adolescents, which is awesome. And I think there needs to be more programs like yours out in the communities that people have actually established out of their heart, because of their heart, their passion
right.
for it. And we have
right.
so many facilities in the country that are receiving funding, and it seems like they're not doing anything. They're not looking at the type of people that they're bringing in. They're just looking at bringing them in and getting them out as soon as possible to bring
exactly.
in more. And
exactly.
there needs to be more programs like yours that actually have the passion to take these young people in, to try to do as much as they can. In your instance, you mentioned empowering these young women. And I think that's what a lot of young women need. And I think a lot of the men, young men and male adolescents, I think they need that male role model, which they don't
yeah.
have. And if there were more males that were opening, you know, foundations and organizations like you know, with Rafa, I think that there'd be more success in the communities and prevention in the prisons as far as incarcerations go. And real quickly, I was going to mention, in Massachusetts, there's been quite a few exonerated black males in the last several years. And the sad thing about it is many of them were wrongfully convicted. When they came out, they won major lawsuits. And instead mm-hmm. of taking some of that money, I mean, we're talking millions, instead of taking
mm-hmm.
some of that money and opening foundations like the
mm-hmm.
one you have maybe
mm-hmm.
for male,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. a lot of them have either gone back to using substances,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and a lot of them have ended up overdosing and dying. A lot of them, there was one that even committed suicide. It's
mm-hmm.
sad because we're looking at these males that could be so so constructive in the work that they can do
mm-hmm.
with that money
mm-hmm.
that they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
But I admire, you know, a program like yours, and I think there needs to be more of them, both in the female sector and also in the male sector.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you.
And what are your thoughts on some of these types of issues where they do come out and they are able to get some funding to start their lives over and do something?
I just think they got to pour back into the community. If they pour back into the community, that it will be real beneficial to them. Right now, you know, everybody is not pouring back into their children. You know, there's some things about what about our children. So we have to be able to support the children throughout the whole aspect, because there's some prevention that needs to happen. There's some interventions that need to be happening. And even within the system, there's not a lot of rehabilitative services that's being offered to
no.
people, you know. So if we offer that to people, then it'd be a better system that can support our children, you know, throughout the processes.
And that's it.
Yeah.
It's really needed. We're living
yeah.
in a country, and I say this all the time, that this country in America, there's such an epidemic of mental illnesses and substance abuses, and the young people today, they don't have the role models. They don't have anyone to look up to. And many
mm-hmm.
of them, they don't even have families that stand by them or support them. And the media hasn't helped much, because the media will take a case and sensationalize on it, make it bigger
right.
than it really is. And sometimes
right.
they're reporting things that they don't even have all the facts, but yet they report it to make matters worse.
Right, right. That's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. So there's, you know, there's a lot that we haven't done yet, and there's still a lot that needs to be done. So I guess we have to, you know, do some risk assessment and just see, do some risk assessments and see what we need to do and how we need to do things and be able to appropriately, you know, assess our communities. You know, because I think it's about assessing our communities and being able to, you know, this is a very rural area and there's very, very limited things here. You know, I just came out of a meeting with people, you know, with a young lady with you know, substance abuse issues, and there's no program in this town that can address her substance abuse issues.
Which makes it even more important that your program is there.
Exactly. Because at least we can do some supportive groups. At least we can have some supportive community outreach. Something can happen.
Have you thought about networking maybe with other foundations and organizations who actually work with the adolescents, whether it be male or female, to maybe connect?
Yes, that's why I'm working with the Kids at Hope. And this young man, Rick Miller, he deals with the whole, it's not a curriculum or anything, it's a mindset of how we deal with our kids. So I'm at the table with probation, I'm at the table with judges, I'm at the table with the schools. And so right now we are dealing with this foundation, and it's called Kids at Hope. And every kid can succeed with no exceptions, you know, and that's a great, great model, you know, program that we are going to be launching here, you know, in Yuma on September the 8th, which is our open house.
Now, if a parent wanted to or an adolescent needed to get in contact or needed the help and they wanted to contact you, how would they do that? I mean, where would they go to connect with you?
I have a phone number. You can reach me at 760-219-1320. And then I have an East Coast number, which is 856-465-4061.
Okay. And the website that you have will give some information to them as well, right?
Yes. They'll give you everything, and then you can reach me by there. If anyone wants to make a donation, they want to support us, they want to sponsor us, you can go to the www.ceyw.org.
Great. There's also, I don't know if you're familiar with the International Network of Prison Ministries, but there's a lot of people, including chaplains and you know, imams and other ministries, a lot of people that have actually gone on, and it's a free website. It's for ministries and foundations across the world. And have you ever thought of maybe getting, and it's a free, you can sign up and you can put down what you want, also include a section for donations on it.
What is it called?
It's called the International Network of Prison Ministries, and it's www.prisonministry.net, and you can, it's just like a page, you can set it up, you know, set up your information and also include a donation button on there as well. But they have a lot of these ministries. They work with homeless people. They work with prisoners. They work with young people, old people, halfway houses, things like that. And I think it's a good thing to have your program also included in that, because it will also you know, bring in more more people that need the help, and also bring in more recognition of the new program you started.
Okay. Excellent.
So, is your program now, is it a nonprofit? Is it a 501c3 or
501c4? We are a nonprofit 501c3.
Okay. Well, that'll be great, because anyone donating money can write it off on their taxes at the end of the year, which is very good. When I had founded New Vision Organization, we were a 501c4. I recently stepped down a couple of months ago, and it was time for me. I was getting too old and too weary to worry about it. But we were a 501c4, which makes it a little bit more difficult, because anyone that does donate, they can't write it off on their taxes. But as a 501c3, you'll have that you know, that opportunity. So it should work out really good.
Excellent. Does anyone have any questions?
So they'll be able to go to the website and be able to call you.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever brought you into doing this kind of work with the youth?
Well, you know, I was a young lady myself that had challenges and, you know, different situations in my life and, you know, barriers and situations. And so that's really where I get the vision and, you know, to do the work that I do is because my own experiences, you know, my own experiences as a young lady having challenges, it allowed me to go back and reach back, because I was one of them people, so I'll go back and I reach back and give back to people, you know. So, you know, I am a therapist, I am an activist, you know, I'm a community, you know, supporter and everything, but I was a young lady who had challenges growing up. So because of my challenges, you know, it just put me in that field of just going back and helping, you know, my girl.
You know, it's really funny, that ironic that you say that. I was speaking with a gentleman earlier today, Don Watts. He's the founder of Yankee Detective Agency. But I was telling Don that. I said the ones that make the best alcohol substance abuse counselors are those that have been there.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that make the best social workers are those who have been there. A lot of times people think you have to go to college, you have to get that piece of paper to be able to be successful. And that piece of paper does not mean anything, because what happens is people that have experienced, and the reason we started speaking about this is because of all the problems going on in this country and the lack of knowledge our government has in addressing the lack of capability they have in addressing these issues the right way. They have that piece of paper, but they're not like the average Americans. Just like a lot of people coming out of college, they don't have the experience. They don't have the things that the normal everyday citizen goes through. But those that have been there, those who have experienced it, this is where wisdom comes in. And you gain that wisdom by being wise. And the only way you gain that wisdom is by experiencing things and getting through it. And with social work, even then, I noticed years ago, when I did it for an agency myself, I would see all these young people coming fresh out of college who had no prior experience with families. They came from prominent backgrounds. They had no children, no husbands, no wives, and they would go into, and they had no knowledge of cultures. And they would go into the homes of these dysfunctional families of all cultures. And they would give them the option of either getting the help or having to have their children placed in foster care. No parent wants to hear that, so they're going to fight back. And then when that happens, it goes to court. It's on a care and protection. The children are taken from the parents or the parents and put in foster care. And that's where a lot of the tragedies happen in the foster homes, either through molestations or through some sort of deaths. And it's all because they're not teaching in colleges, in the universities. They're not teaching these young people who are going to be working with families of all cultures. They're not teaching them anything about cultures, but they expect them to learn about algebra and chemistry and all these things, which have nothing to do with it. So that's why I say a lot of times we need people who have been there and back. And what you were just saying about your own experience, this is where the young girls that you're going to be working with will be able to relate to you, because you have that actual experience that they are going through.
Right. Because now I'm seeing that the substance abuse is a major issue. I need to go back and reevaluate and put in some other services through my nonprofit, because it's sad. Like, these girls need recovery coaches. You know, they just need good people who care.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And if we are not assessing and giving them what they need, it's sad that we do not have a substance abuse program or anything in this town to address substance abuse needs.
No.
You know what I mean? When 60% of the youth are doing meth.
That's it.
That's sad. Meth is a very hard drug.
Yeah.
That's a very intensive, hard drug. It's something that we can't take lightly. People are killed. In Las Vegas, just around about a week or two ago, a mother shot her kid in the head. The kid is on life support, maybe a vegetable, due to meth.
Yeah, that's sad.
So we can't take this lightly, and we can't continue to think that, oh, they're just doing it, and, oh, they'll be okay, and, oh, if we just fill them up with all these services, that they'll be fine. No, they won't be fine. They got some intensive stuff that they have to address, and if we don't have the proper people to address it, then we need to refer out.
Exactly. Exactly. That's
so
exactly
that's
what's needed.
That's the kind of advocate that I am, and that's the stuff that I'm encountering. You've been you're a social worker. You know how it is.
Yeah. It's sad because they don't know how much they're hurting these young people with their lack of experience, and yet it's something that they're not willing to actually try to change. You know, they're not looking at trying to find the right resolutions. They're just looking at putting together programs. It's like having these parents who are their children are 5 years of age, so they say, okay, now the children are of age, you put them in school, we'll give you the daycare vouchers to go out there and get a job, but yet they don't look at these parents who have no transportation, they have no way of getting to work, or the daycare is open before or after they go, they have to be at work. So if, and I say this all the time, if they're going to put a plan together, do it 100% right. Because that may be a failure if they don't do it right the first time.
I agree 100%, and that is what's happening, and that's what I just seen coming out of a meeting just now, is that the treatment plan that we have is just not working.
No.
So if this treatment plan is not working, then we need to reevaluate it to get it to work.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Because we're hurting the person more than helping them. So in order to help them, we got to give them the tools they need to get through what they need to get through.
And it's not that difficult. It's really not. If the recruiters or the coordinators or whatever, if they're doing it the right way, it shouldn't be difficult.
Exactly.
All they need to do is look at it as though if it's my family member, how would I want to see this done? And
right,
take it
right
from there.
Right. Now, I love the work that I'm doing. I'm also a foster parent. I love the work that I'm doing. I love the girls that I have. You know, I encounter things with my girls, but I love them all. You know what I mean? And, you know, come January when I have to be able to release them to somewhere else, because I am going to have to release them and do something else because my husband will be home, it was a great experience for me. I enjoyed the experience. You know, so, you know, I'm a girl with all kind of hats. I wear all kind of hats. I take hats off and I put hats on, you know. But I've been designated to do this journey work here in Yuma. It's very rural, but I'm up for every challenge that I have to come across, because one thing it is about is the baby. It is about the kids.
Mm-mm. No.
You know, and I learned that from you know, people like you, Miss Lona, that it is about the children, and we can't forget about the babies, you know, and we have to be able to support them through their transitions. Even when they fall, we still got to support them, and it's going to be a process. We don't like everything, but we still got to support them and give them the help that they need.
That's it. Someone had mentioned, I saw on Facebook, where parents, we needed to pray for parents who have given up on their children who have ended up in prison. And I say one of the things that people fail to realize across the board is that our children never asked to be brought into this world. And I remember one time my mother and I had an argument. God rest her soul. I loved my mother dearly. But we had an argument, and I said to my mother said to me, you know, I brought you into this world. And I know I hurt her feelings when I said it, but I said, Mom, I never asked to be brought into this world. I didn't ask to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. Mm-hmm. We don't ask to be brought into this world. Our children don't. So if our children fail, it's like these pro-lifers, they, you know, against abortions. Well, who are they? Who are they to decide whether or not someone should have an abortion? Because what happens, they promote life at one end, and they want to take it at the other end. So if someone commits a crime, they're crying, you know, death penalty, or they're crying, you know, put them in prison for life without. If these people are that bent on having them serve their sentence in that horrific way, then why be so quick to be for pro-life? Our kids didn't ask to be brought into this world. So I really think it's a shame that we have to deal with such hypocrites And that's all. That's what it's all about. A bunch of hypocrites in this country that are willing at one end to save a life and at the other end to take a life. And this is what's going on all over the place.
Exactly. So we're dealing with people like that, and their mindsets are like that. And as long as their mindsets are like that, the babies are suffering. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And it's really like, you know, there's a young woman right now that I'm encountering with, both of her parents is not here. They're incarcerated. Not once have anybody said, do you want to go see them?
Yeah.
Do you need to see them? Would that help you to see them? You know what I'm saying? They're people too. And they need her too, like she needs them. You know what I mean? So we're still not there yet. We've got to get better with some things. But we got a lot of work to do here. We got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. We live in a very cold society, and like I say, it's not right that the people should be so quick to judge. No one knows what causes a person to break or to fall.
Exactly.
There's so many different reasons.
So many factors that come in place when someone has lost their way and they just can't do it any longer. You know, there are so many factors. When we have children taking on adult responsibilities and they're taking on being adults and they you know, have these real big things that they have to encounter as kids, I just think that, you know, like one of my young ladies, she had to do things as an adult. She had to be the adult in the family, you know. And now we tell her, no, you need to be the kid. And that's hard for her. You know what I mean? So we still have to love these kids, give them what they need, and support them throughout their transition or through it all, you know. I'm one of the advocates that is able and willing to do what I need to do. And so I took the torch. I took the torch to do this work, and I'm going to keep doing it until the day I die.
Amen.
Yes, I'll do it to the day I die because I love what I do. You know, money helps, but it's not the drive of my passion. My passion is when kids can see and they're with their families and they're coming back and saying, thank you for being there. Thank you for opening up your house. Thank you for having a program for me. Thank you for believing in me. You know?
And you know, Laura, it's that kind of passion that makes people want to give, makes people want to be able to, you know, to contribute to something like that. And it's with your heart, you're not out for it for the money, but you're the type of person that people would want to contribute to because they know your heart is really into it. And I think it takes money to be successful in running an organization or foundation. You know, basically that's one of the reasons why I stepped down, because I was not able or trying to bring in funding, whereas people that were working in the organization, a lot of them were coming and going. They didn't want to stay because there was no monies involved. The person that's running it now, he will be able to bring in funding. The unfortunate thing is, will he have the same passion? And that's what others have said to me. And I hope and pray that it won't be just about money with him. I hope that he will have some passion there for the people that I've been trying to help all these years. And sometimes it doesn't work out that way. But I really, like I say, I really I admire you for the work that you're doing, and I'm hoping and praying that it's going to be successful, and I believe it will be because I know where your heart is.
Yes, it will be successful. We are the first, and we will be actually maybe taking this model throughout the, you know, the country. You know, once we get it set up, then maybe other people can replicate it, and they'll be able to do similar of the same stuff that we're doing.
Really, exactly. And also going into the universities and the schools, the colleges, you know, speaking about the issues. And I think it would be a good experience even for the girls that you're working with to maybe, you know, get them prepared to go in with you, a couple of them at a time, and talk to them, going to the YMCA, the YWCA, talking about the, you know, the things that brought them to the area where they were, and the things that the ways that you have helped or the ways that they have gotten the help to get themselves together where they, you know, they have some kind of self-esteem and self-confidence in what they're doing.
Exactly. So we're going to work on that. We're going to work on a team of a speakers bureau and have these girls go out in the community and speak about, you know, their lives and speak about what they're doing and going to the school system. So, you know, we have to deal with one thing at a time. And right now, just creating the model and creating the program is the first initiative. And then after that, we'll do the groundwork of doing some advocacy and leadership and things of that nature.
Mm. Well, I'm hoping, too, at some point in time you'll be able to come back on the show and maybe talk, you know, give us an update on how things are going. I'd love to see how everything works out. And I'm going to be talking today a little bit more later on about the issues that are going on in the country. And I wanted to try to squeeze some of that in today, too, because what's happening right now is very serious, and we have some major issues, and a lot of people have been concerned with the issues that are going on right now with these wrongful deaths and what's going on around it. And we need to try to work on some of that as well to try to see what's causing it all, which we really know a lot about the reason, but we can't understand why these young kids have to be dying unnecessarily. Because of all of this. But again, I'm just hoping that we can have you on the show again and that maybe you can talk more about, you know, what's happened since this last interview, and keep us informed as well.
I will. And just to closing, I wanted to say one thing about Shannon and his experience. He just seen a group of lawyers on Thursday, which was fantastic. One thing they did say that is in his favor, that he has matured since he's been in prison. So that's a great thing. He wrote a book, he got married, you know. He's not as angry as he used to be. So a lot of things has transitioned and has transformed in his life. You know, it is not going to be an easy world for Shannon when he comes home. We know that. You know, and part of a loved one and a wife is that I would live a busy life. So I have to be able to have time for my husband and respect his wishes when he wants to have time to himself. I need to give him that time to himself because he's never been out here in this world. So everything is new to him. And I have to prepare my life and my lifestyle to be able to accommodate and respect, you know, that he's been living in a cell for 18 years with another man. And it's very, very difficult for him to come out to society and regroup with limited resources.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because there's Hakeem. I wish I knew we were going to be talking about this. I would love to have had him on the show with us. Hakeem was abused severely in Illinois, in Marion, Illinois prison years ago. But when he was released, his wife Vanessa, she used to talk about how he was so used to being in that little cell for so many years that when he got out, he was so used to it that he spent all his time in his room. She would go to work and come home, and he would be in his room in this little because he was so used to it. And the sad thing about it is that he had a laptop, and I don't know if he still does it, but and he's a sweetheart. I'll tell you, he's been through a lot, and I admire him for being able to come out of it the way he did. But he would take that computer. He'd leave it in his room all the time. He did everything he was doing was out of his room, and it's a shame because these cells are so tiny. They're so tiny that these prisoners have nowhere to move, and they're living. Right. They actually are caged like animals, and I don't think that anybody should have to live like that, especially in America. I don't care if they committed a crime or not. If this is going to be their home for a long length of time, the least that our country can do is to give them a cell that's big enough, at least I don't care if it's studio size, but it shouldn't be as tight and as
your bathroom.
congested as the bathroom. Exactly. And I think it's terrible. And you're right. When Sean comes out, Sean is going to be having to adjust all over again, and it's not going to be easy. And that's a very sad situation for anybody to have to be in. And that's why I can understand why when they talk about in America, they talk about prisons in America being having the highest rates of incarcerations and the highest rates of human rights violation. Well, if you can cage somebody in a cell, but that size of a cell, and expect them to live with another man, like you mentioned, that's not an easy thing. But they will promote that. They will promote something like that, and even though they know it's wrong, and I don't give them, again, going back to what I said before, we have people that are making up laws that they don't even know how to do. They're making up laws to address issues they don't even know how to begin. And this is why we have so much crime when people come out of prison. They end up going out and raping somebody, or they end up going out and committing another crime because they don't know how to live. And I have to say with Sean is very, and I hope he realizes this, Sean is very, very fortunate to have you, because you are going to be able to do more for him than a lot of these wives and husbands are able to do, because you, you've been an advocate. You've been out there struggling to make it right, so that when he does come out, he's going to have something a lot of prisoners won't have. And and that's very, again, that's something that I admire in you, Laura, because prisoners need someone. They need people like you, whether it be their parents or whether it be strangers. This is exactly what they need.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Miona, and I appreciate that. And, you know, I keep getting encouragement every day because, you know, I used to call you when I was harassed by the prison, the guards, and, you know, they took my visits, and, you know, they treated us real mean because of our religion, you know, a lot of different things that happened.
I would really like to have you talk more about that as well.
You know, when we went through our terms of our visiting, me and my husband would be harassed a lot because we both are Muslim. And the people going into the prison in California, they didn't even know how to check us. They didn't even know how to check my hair. You know, so that goes to show the cultural competency that they had. They didn't have no cultural, you know, competency at all. You know, they just didn't care. You know, and throughout the first, you know, I've been going in now around about 4 years, but the first two, three years, I was being harassed. They thought I was bringing drugs. I was constantly, you know, I would sit there with my husband and we would talk. They think that we were too close talking. Every little thing we did, they would be on us and they would be harassing us. You know, my husband is not a troublemaker. He stays to himself. He's not a person who gets involved with a lot of stuff. But for some reason, because of his religion and, you know, him making changes, they liked him being angry. They rather him being angry and being in riots, going in the hole, you know, things of that nature. They didn't like him being a very civilized person and having a woman come and seeing him and being, you know, getting back acclimated, you know, with another human being. They don't like that. They want you to be animalized and, you know, thinking very, you know, mean.
Yeah.
And my husband had to, sometimes, you know, he would go. We would leave visits. The guards would overcheck kind of nonsense that you don't have to go intensively in doing. You know what I'm saying? So sometimes they would go extra and beyond and try to humiliate him and degrade him, you know, and he got mad about that stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of issues within the prison system with racism, you know what I mean, prejudice, everything, you know. And we experienced that, and it was very, very hard. But now we're at the end of this thing, and it made me a stronger person. I thought they wanted me to run away from them, you know, or something. But I didn't run. I ran closer to them.
That was good.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I have seen in all the years that I've been a New Vision organization, when I started that in 2004, but I had been advocating for prisoners for the last 18 years. And one of the things that I can actually say I have seen myself, and they may say they may say that that the prisoners of all color get abused and seriously abused. But uh-huh. I have seen more with the minorities. And one of the things I'm going to say is one prisoner had his light in the cell turned on and kept on 24/7. Uh-huh. His light alone, the sleep deprivation that you see in war zones and you see in battlefields and in uh-huh. prisoners of war, this is what a lot of young black males have to go through. And when I say black males, I mean Hispanic. I know a lot of times they don't consider themselves, but the thing is, it's with any type of minority in those areas. They have kept the lights on 24/7. They have, like you say, struck them in the genitals. I was visiting someone one time years ago in a Pennsylvania prison, and there was a wife and husband and children that were having a visit. And all of a sudden, I heard this guard, for no reason at all, just went off and started hollering and screaming at that man and telling his family to get out of there. And I got ready to say something, and the person that I was visiting said, no, please, because if you say something, they're going to end up going off on you. Well, you know, when prisoners can say they'll end up going off on you, and you're saying, they're not going to go off on me because I'm not a prisoner. But you know what prisoners will tell you? They will go off on you. They will make it difficult for you. So what happens is you sit there and you watch these people. And as soon as the wife got thrown out, a bunch of guards follow that prisoner back to his cell. And I said, I hate to see what's going to happen when that prisoner gets back there. But these are the things that happen. And then they wonder why we have such hatred for law enforcement. You know, and I have to pray at nighttime. I have to pray because when I go to bed at nighttime after hearing about all the stuff that goes on in this
I know.
I go to bed and I have trouble sleeping because it hits me so hard that all of this is going on, and I say, what kind of parents did these guards, did these people that are doing all this abuse, what kind of parents do they have? How were they raised? I don't give parents credit if they can raise their children to have that kind of hatred in them. The parents got to be, to me, the parents have to be just plain sadistic.
Right. That's true, Ms. Marilyn, that's true. So we're still not there with the parents. We're still not there with the system. We got a long way to go, but hopefully people will be able to come around and get themselves together and regroup and, you know, get things back together because we're still not where we're supposed to be.
We're not.
Okay.
We're not. One thing I will say, though,
I would love to come back.
There are people that are in the white sector. There are people who are also tired of it, of what's going on.
Yes.
The reason I say that is because President Obama, he did win the election a couple of times, and had it not been for we don't make up 60% or 55%. So it had to be others who wanted him in. And so the way I look at it is that there are some good white people. Just like they say, there are some good law enforcement, there are some good guards. But you know what? A prisoner once said, if a guard sees abuses going on, or sees a prisoner being severely abused or deprived, and they don't do anything about it, even though they're not the ones that are doing it, they are part of the problem because they're not saying anything. They're allowing it to happen.
Exactly. So I'm excited about the movement. I'm excited about the new journey that I'm experiencing. And I thank you, and I will be consulting with you anytime you need me. You can call on me, and I will be here to support any way that I can.
I'll tell you, I believe that, and I want to thank you again, Laura, for being on. You've been a blessing, and I really appreciate your being here with us, and I do want to see you come on again.
Thank you so much. And
hopefully by then you'll be really up and running, and you can tell us a lot about the progress and the good things that have happened.
Okay, give me a few months, and I'll report back in.
Okay, and you tell Sean that we're all rooting for him, and I hope everything goes well when he comes out. We'd like to have him on the show with us.
Excellent, and I think he'll be excited to tell his story.
Okay. Take care, Laura. Thank
Alrighty,
you so much.
Have a great day.
Oh, and for those that weren't able to be on the to listen to the show, it will be posted. It'll be posted on Facebook. They can click on the link and they'll be able to hear the entire show. I'll send you the information as well.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, I'm going to speak a little bit about this whole thing with the Ferguson, Missouri issue and Michael Brown, because this case has touched my heart. This young man, to be killed the way he was a tragic event. It should never have happened. And I can understand why so many people are so frustrated with the system and the way things have gone with these ongoing deaths. And it's getting to be more and more acceptable to a lot of people that it shouldn't be. It's happening more because these people know they can get away with it. And I myself, I don't think that it's going to get any better, because apparently there are people out there who are promoting the whole thing of getting it even, to become even worse. The KKK getting involved is something that I would have not even been surprised with, because this is their chance to do some more damage. And I myself just wanted to say, I don't agree with our government. I don't agree with the government that is divided. And I believe in this case, our government is so divided that is why the American people have not been able to get beyond the economic issues, have not been able to get past all of the talks of wars in other countries. And I think it's time that we started to come together to make a change. And I'm talking about all colors who are really seriously wanting to make a change. But for those that are not, all I can say is if a person is raised right, if they are brought into this world and they are taught love and compassion, understanding, if they are taught that you do not harm other people because of the differences in their color or their religion, then those are the people that I can say were brought up right. But if you have an inkling of evil in you to want to see somebody killed or want to side with a system, a legal system, that's all about this kind of violence, then, again, as I mentioned earlier, the problem is with you as well. We want to start writing letters, just like we do with the abused in the prisons. We want to start writing letters to whomever it takes to stop this ignorance that's going on in this country. And if the police cannot be contained in their violence, then they need to be removed from the police force. They need to be removed from the prisons. They need to be removed from any position that they may have that deals with public relations, whether it be in the school system, whether it be in the prisons, or whether it be anywhere else. So we need to start looking at coming together and trying to fight this whole thing as far as the system goes with the penal abuses that are going on. I cannot imagine what this family is going through, nor can I imagine what the Trayvon case, his parents were about, what they were going through, what they've been going through throughout these years. But I can tell you one thing. If any of you have children, I know that you wouldn't want to see those children murdered in the way that these children have been murdered. And this racism has got to stop, because there's nothing more than a clear indication of the pigmentation of the skin being different than others. The blood is the same. The feelings, the pain that everyone goes through is the same. There is no difference in the lives of others, any different than your own. The one thing that is different is some people are raised to love. My mother used to teach us never to laugh or make fun of anybody who was deformed, anybody who was different in any way when it came to disfigurements, or when it came to mental health issues, or when it came to the religions, or when it came to any of those things. I refuse to go to bed every night having to deal with the thought that there are people out there that deserve to be incarcerated themselves, and because they wear a uniform, they don't have to worry about it. And as long as our government keeps permitting this, then this is going to continue, and it's not going to get better. It's only going to get much, much worse. I'm very disappointed in our country. I'm very disappointed. And this thing, as far as the veterans, I had a lot of members of my family were military. I had 3 brothers in the Marines. I had 2 sisters in the Army. I had 1 brother in the Air Force. I had a father that was in World War II. All of this was not about them when they came out. It was not about the military versus others, immigration, military versus the criminal justice system, military. Someone mentioned post-traumatic stress syndrome, and someone else mentioned, yeah, it's the prisoners have it too because of the way they were treated. And someone turned around and said, well, that's a different story. It's no different story. Prisoners, if they haven't gone through the post-traumatic stress syndrome before their incarceration, they sure in hell are going through it after their incarceration because of the treatment that they have received. So it's not just about the military men. And this military issue, if it's all about just the military, then we can forget there is a God, because I think that's what's happening. They're putting military over God himself. And if there's a God, if there's a military, then let the military stop all this violence going on. But there is a God, and God is not about violence. He's not about all this crap that's going on with this racism and these deaths. So make your choice. You want to continue to support the military men, or maybe promote them coming back to a country they live in that they don't fight for. Because we're not fighting for America when we send our troops over to another country. Unless that country affects us in some way, we're not fighting for America. Other countries are fighting their own battles. Okay, and if we just get out and let them fight their own battles until we can get ourselves stabilized in our own country, because until we can straighten things out in our own country, we're not helping any country. You have to take care of business at home before you can take care of business anywhere else. And this promoting the flag, this promoting everything to me that's causing deaths over and over again. This is America, the same people that are being killed. The same people that are being killed, their children, those people, many of them, served in World War II. Many of them lost their lives or lost friends in World War II. So, in other words, in this country, we're good enough to fight the battles of America, but yet we're not good enough to be able to live in the same communities, to be able to live a normal life without having our loved ones destroyed. And the reason for many people being in prison is because they have been distorted from all that's going on. The racism has affected everybody's child who is a minority. And all these people that get upset because their loved ones were killed by a black person, well, they better think about what they have done to their own, because their own children wouldn't be murdered, wouldn't be killed, wouldn't even be threatened if it wasn't for them doing it first. And I hate to say this, but that's how it is. So I hope and pray that everyone, and this is going to be short, because I am sick and tired of listening to all of this garbage about all of this racism, and I am sick and tired of hearing about all these young people who are dying left and right because of some ignorant society that we live in. And that's what it is. I have no use for the members of society in America anymore, especially those of you who will sit back and watch all these things happen with no compassion, with no heart, and then try to say it's not only the blacks that are going through it, because it is. A lot of it, most of it, 75% of it, are African-American males who are being executed. And I just want to let everybody know this, because this is something that has touched my heart, for a parent to lose their son all because of racist gods. And that's what it is, racist gods. So please think about it, and please put yourself in the shoes of these parents who are losing their kids over racism, whether it be black or white. If somebody teaches their children to hate someone because of their race, then the person that does the killing is not the person that killed their loved one. It's themselves. You cannot teach your kids hatred and expect nothing in return, because sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never hurt me is a saying they used to have. That's not the way it goes anymore, because names can hurt. Names can hurt. Not only names, but also hatred. Ongoing provocation, ongoing bullying, ongoing discussions about races, ongoing everything. People cannot take it anymore. Anybody that thinks that they can talk about someone else and knock them down because of their race or their religion, they're only causing problems not only for themselves, for their children who are going to be growing up in the same kind of hatred. If you love your kids, you're going to want the best for them. And that best for them is to teach them love for one another, as it says in the Bible. For many of you that don't believe in the Bible, you should try to read it, because it'll teach you something about true love. It'll teach you something about what life is really about. And that life is not about hatred. It's not about killing. And I wanted everyone to know this. I'm going to pray for every one of you, who has any doubts as to who God is and what his whole plan is as far as love goes, his teachings. I want everybody to know this. Love your enemies. Love those who hate you. And love those you hate. Because right now, the majority of people in this world are becoming very cold-hearted and careless, and they could care less about the other person. Myself, I want to see some love, and I may not ever see it in this lifetime, but we all have to meet our Maker. We all have to be judged someday. Even though you may not see it now, you may not think it'll ever happen, there will be a day. If the flood happened, we can believe that this next ending, as predicted in the Bible, through flood, no more. Through fire, it will be. And this world is going to end in such a horrific, horrific, violent ending that we better all come together, because this is what's going to happen. And we can't change our mind at the last minute and decide we love our neighbor. We have to do it quickly now. We only get this one last chance. And I hope that all of you will consider this and pray for one another and know that the violence that's going on in this country today is not necessary, but as a result, many people will die from it. That I can assure you. Good day, goodbye, and join us next Monday at 3 o'clock to discuss
Leona?
Other things. Yes.
Leona, how are you? I tell you, I enjoyed your interview today with your guest. What was her name again?
Laura Griffin Smith.
Laura Griffin Smith. And what is the name of her organization again?
It's called RAFHA. RAFHA Incorporated.
RAFHA Incorporated. Do you know what that word means?
You know what? She mentioned it, and I didn't even think to ask her again. No, I don't.
Okay.
I can find
All right.
that out.
Well, yes, I enjoyed listening to her, and also I enjoyed listening to your summary of what's going on and how you feel about it. I wondered, had you gotten access to the report that says that Michael Brown was shot from the front, all the bullets
yes.
entered the
yes.
front, except for two that entered his head.
You
Did
know,
you
Mary,
that report?
Yes, and what has me so upset right now, and I'm very upset about it, is the fact that they are trying to, and this is a kid they said was supposed to be going to college the next day. This is a case where they are trying to say that before the shooting, he had robbed a store. And this is garbage. This is all garbage. This is only because they want to justify the damage done by their own. And I'm sick and tired of hearing about the brotherhood. I'm sick and tired of hearing about these people that stick together because they have the same uniforms. And it has to stop. And I, you know what? I just can't deal with it anymore. I have felt so bad for this family, for what this woman's going through, and I'm sick and tired of the racist people we have in this country. And we have a lot of them. We have a lot of them. They use our own people against us, and our own people fall for it. But what they're doing is they're bringing violence on their own children, because it's the young children of today who are going to make up this world if it survives another generation. It's the young people who are going to make up this world. And as long as these young people are being taught that kind of hatred, they're going to have short lives too. And these people don't understand it. They can't love their children that much if they're going to teach their children this kind of hatred to do something like that. And ever since the death of Michael Brown, I have seen so many things coming across Facebook of other incidences that have been going on across the country. A lot of them. And
well, as you know, eight deaths at police have happened since July 17th when Mr. Garner was choked to death in New York. We've had seven since then.
Jeez.
Seven. So we've got a record going of about two citizens dead per week by police violence. And I'm talking about unarmed citizens.
A mother tried to tell the police that her son, he was autistic. She's trying to tell them he's autistic. And they tell her to shut up, and they ended up killing her son, shooting her son to death, an autistic teenager.
What was his name?
It's on Facebook. I can get the name and forward it to you. But these are the things that are, all the truth is coming out now. And this is another one. He had a colostomy bag or whatever attached to him. And they thought he had something in his pants. And other than it was that. And they ended up shooting him for that. It's like they're just going crazy, and it's because they can get away with it. And when they have to justify it, they try to say this young Michael Brown robbed a store just before it happened. Witnesses saw the whole thing, and this kid wasn't even in a store. He was walking down the street minding his own business. And all the shots in that kid's head and his arms, that showed that he was trying to defend himself. He was trying to just simply defend himself. Young kids trying to mind their own business. It reminds me of the Emmett Till case. You know, with Emmett Till, these animals, these people that have this kind of animalistic attitude, behavior, to do the things that they're doing, I can't understand how they can get away with all this, other than the fact that we still have so much racism in this country that they're allowed to get away with anything they want. And like spoiled little brats, the more they get away with, the more they're going to do. I don't know.
I do know that there are some things that can be done. And I don't know if you saw it or not, but I made a list of what I feel like would help address these unfortunate police murders. And that would be on that page. It's just some about seven quick things that could be done that would end, I think they would end police murders if they were put into practice. And one thing that needs to be done, all of these things have to do with police accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be something that we're all interested in, because you understand that these wrongful deaths are going to have to be paid for. And they're paid for by citizens, taxpayers.
Taxpayers dollars. That's it.
They don't really know. A lot of people don't know it, But most police departments, the police officers have immunity. And so they don't have to pay anything. In fact, they get a paid vacation when they kill someone. So
I noticed that. That man got, that police officer ended up with paid leave. Can you believe that? Paid leave while they
investigate. That's what happens all the time. And there's no effect to the police officers because they're protected by our system. They're protected by the, usually the DA is on their side. The government is on their side. And they, if they do get indicted, which is very rare, they don't have to pay the lawyers. They're given a lawyer. So, in other words, they can commit a horrible crime, even a murder, and suffer none of the consequences that the citizens would suffer if they did the same thing. I mean, they're protected on every end from any consequences for their actions. And so I have these seven things that would change all of that. Would you like for me to read them?
Yes, please. And let us know let me know which website, I mean, where on the website we can find the other things that you recommended.
Okay. And then I would like to get your opinion on these and how you feel like they would work or why you feel like they would work.
Okay.
I say that we owe it to Michael Brown and seven other victims of police violence within a month's time, plus a critically wounded Ferguson protester, to demand, number one, demilitarization of police departments. Cops who cannot be trusted with handguns should not have access to tanks, helicopters, grenades, and machine guns. So we need to take the military equipment from these police officers. And number two, we need immediate drug and alcohol testing of all police officers involved in or accused in brutality and wrongful death matters. Periodic testing of officers without notice is also needed. And number three, we need speedy, honest investigations of every claim alleging brutality and loss of life. Number four, we need removal of immunity for abusive police officers and prosecution for crime. They should be prosecuted for their crimes. They're released of duty, but they need to be prosecuted. Expose offenders to criminal and personal liability. They should be criminally responsible if once their case is investigated and it's found to be a wrongful attack on a citizen or a wrongful death, they should be prosecuted. I talked to a family yesterday, just interrupting here. The Listen Biglers were on our radio show again yesterday. It was Daniel Listen Bigler's mom, Valerie, and her grandmother, Miss Frances. And they pointed out that when Daniel Listen Bigler was murdered in Clay County Jail in Florida, the medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. That means murder. It was found to be murder. It was ruled a murder, and not a single person has been charged with his death. They know which officers went to his cell and got him out of there. They know which ones marched him down the hall into that little room. They know who did it. But nobody's been charged, although his death was ruled homicide. That needs to stop. Police officers need to be criminally charged if they did murders. Why should they be sitting there waiting on the next person's son to come into that jail? And Valerie told me that she was aware that that three other inmates in that facility had been threatened by the guards, said, if you all right, if you act up, we're going to do the same to you that we did to Listen Bigler. So in other words, they're using their previous murder as a threat to other people. They're saying, we killed them, yeah, and we'll kill you too. So there is no repentance where there is no punishment. Understand that. So now, number five is, every officer at the scene, when a person's human and civil rights were violated, must be held criminally responsible under the law of parties. Do to them what the law says. If you and I go out to rob a store and I kill somebody, they're not just going to charge me with the murder. They're going to charge us both with the murder. Am I right or wrong?
You're right. You're right.
That's called the law of parties. What they did with the Oscar Grant case, I saw what happened. You had three or four police officers. You had one of them that stretched him out and held his arms. You had another one that held this young man's legs. And you have another one that straddled his back and shot him. I say they all killed him, but they only charged one police officer. So I think that police officers who are at the scene when a citizen is murdered like that should all be charged under the law of parties. And then number six, officers charged must either pay for their own legal defense or use the public defender's office. That's not what happens to police. They don't have to worry about chunking up the money for their own lawyer. And they don't have to worry about using the overworked public defender's office. They pay for them to have the best lawyers that they can get. And that's not coming out of their pay. It's not coming out of their pocket. So I think that is wrong. If public defenders are good enough for everybody else, why aren't they good enough for murderous police officers? You know?
Exactly.
And if they don't want to use the public defender, that's fine. They need to go and put their house in hock. They need to go and sell their cars. They need to empty their bank out and pay for a better lawyer who would have more time to devote to their case if they choose not to use the public defender. But taxpayers should not have to pay for officers who have been charged with crimes. And the seventh thing is that payment of lawsuits should begin with the surrender of the offending police officer's personal assets. Say you have a police officer who's been on the force 20 years. He's got a house. He's got a little vacation cabin. He's got a boat. He's got a couple of cars. He's got a few thousand dollars in the bank. They're not rich, but over a period of time, you can amass a little bit of assets. And so if this person has caused a $3 million, $10 million, some of them a $15 million wrongful death lawsuit, that it should start with whatever they've got. They're the ones who did it. Why should it be hands off their houses? Why should it be hands off their cars, their bank accounts? If they're the ones who caused all of this expense on taxpayers, why shouldn't the paying begin with them? Why are they not having to sell or put a lien against their own house? So those are seven things that I think would help. I know it would help. Because, see, these officers, they'll tell you, I didn't think about it. Or I thought it was a pistol, but it was a cell phone. The girl they killed on the I think it was the 13th, who they hadn't named last time I checked, they killed her. She was a mentally ill girl. She was holding an electric drill that was not even plugged up.
I heard about that.
Some kind of weapon. The thing is that if it was their house, that would be taken. If it was their cars, that would be taken. If it was their bank account, that would be taken for their wrongful death. They would make sure that people really have a gun. They wouldn't kill people like they have in the past because they had a Coca-Cola bottle. They
They shoot and ask questions later. It shouldn't be like that. We're not living in that kind of country, or we shouldn't be living in that kind of country. But the thing is, I was going to say, too, the materials that they own, a lot of them don't even own that, had it not been for the abuses. They take from these prisoners. You know, they take their shower shoes, they take their clothing, they take a lot of the things, the little bits of things that these prisoners are able to save up to get, they take it. And then when they have allowed the prisoners to reorder, saying that they'll pay for it, the prisoners reorder. But the thing is, when it comes in, they take it. So the prisoners are buying stuff with their own money, having it taken from them, and then when they reorder, it goes to the guards. So this is the way the guards are getting things from them. And it's not just with that. These guards own all these fantastic houses. Where do they get the monies, to be able to even afford those things, had it not been for them stealing from others or participating in these murders and covering up for their peers? They're getting all this from their own blood, from the bloodshed of all these prisoners. People don't know it. People do not know what's going on in the prisons, but they don't realize that these prisoners are suffering enormously at the hands of these guards, and these guards are covering for one another. They're getting away with murder, and that's why they feel like they can do it again. What you're saying, it sounds good. It sounds like something that we should all be able to do is get out there and demand. But you look at Lindsay Lohan and all these celebrities who are getting away with all the crimes they're getting away with because of their money. So it's not in this country. What's happening right now is this country is about power. It's about who you are or what you have. And this is why so many of them, like that Sports Illustrator or whatever his name is, his son finally ended up going to prison after all these years because his father couldn't cover for him anymore after he murdered that girl. And that girl, she cried out for help. And what did they do? They didn't even put him in prison. They didn't even give him they didn't put him in jail. They let him out the same day she filed that complaint. What happened that night? She ended up dying. This is the power. This is what people are getting away with murder because of their power. And these guards, these prison guards, they're getting away with so much that this is not going to stop. It's not going to stop until something happens. And your idea right now is a good idea. We should pursue it. We should try to get others on Facebook and wherever we can to start doing something about it because, Mary, if it doesn't happen, we're going to continue to see these kind of deaths going on. It's escalating every single day. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And unless we can do something about it, we're going to end up losing a lot of our people, a lot of them, to these animals. And that Lindsay...
I see something different about that, Leona. I think that what is going to happen is that these police officers acting like they're in a war and they've gone to war against black people. And that's primarily been killed in all of these incidents. Out of the 8 deaths, 5 of them were black, and 6 may have been, because the young girl, they have not told anything about it when I read this, about what her race was or what her name was. So it may be 6 black people out of 8 who were killed. Now, what is going to happen is, first of all, people aren't going to keep taking it, okay? That's why I said this is a matter of Homeland Security. Justice is a matter of Homeland Security, because if you have no justice, you will have no peace. And so that's not a threat. That is just a matter of fact. There cannot be peace in an unjust environment. And so, in other words, no people are going to continue to watch their own be slaughtered and do nothing about it. In fact, many people did more when Michael Brown was killed than has happened in a long time, because we began to realize that the courts won't give you justice. We began to realize that at the most, they will throw a few dollars at the impacted family, but they won't give you justice because the person who killed your relative is still walking around. As Daniel Listenbigger's family pointed out yesterday, and by the way, that is a Caucasian family, that they killed a 19-year-old, and they tried to first cover it up, which is traditional. Now, what I'm seeing is that these conservative newspapers and news media are, like you said, harping on the fact that Michael Brown may have been seen in that video in that store, and the appearance is that he took a carton of cigarettes. That's how it appears. And then number two, they've done the autopsy now, and they said Michael Brown had marijuana in his system. Now, the thing is, what has that got to do with the cop killing him? The cop didn't know that he had even been to the store. He stopped Michael Brown because Michael Brown was walking in the street. So mm-hmm. The fact that Michael Brown might or might not have been on video taking a carton of cigarettes does not even
justify.
Come into the picture.
No,
why he was kicked. And the man didn't even know that Michael Brown had been to the store. That's not why Michael Brown was stopped. So it's just too late to bring that in. That doesn't even matter. That's completely immaterial. What he did 15 minutes before he met that cop, it's completely immaterial, number one. And number two, as somebody pointed out, the film that we saw of him in the store was not a consistent film. In other words, it showed bits and pieces. It would jump back to this and jump back to that,
mm-hmm.
just like
I saw that.
Cameras do. It was suggested that Michael had paid for those cigarettes and that the store clerk was mistaken.
Yeah.
That's what was suggested. That Michael had paid for the cigars and that the store clerk just was messing with him. You know, the thing is, who steals something and then walk out so slowly? And then they turn around and come back to confront the person who's accusing them. That doesn't seem reasonable to me.
Mm-mm, mm-mm.
It just really doesn't. So I'm just wondering, is there any truth in the allegation that there had been a robbery? There have been people who walk in stores and steal something, but usually they hit that door running. And I run away.
You're right, and I believe all that was planned.
The thing is that since the camera was jumping around, we don't know whether he paid for the cigarettes or not, because the camera was not consistently trained on him while he was in the store. And number two, the autopsy shows that all the bullets entered Michael Brown from the front. I want to let people know a little something, if I can, real quickly about these autopsies. I want the United States of America and the whole wide world to know that medical examiners lie. So, in case you didn't know, medical examiners lie. I want you to, and they omit information. I want you to read about the medical examiner who examined Trayvon Martin. He implied after they fired him that his own examination should be questioned. He implied that the prosecutor was not really trying to put Zimmerman behind bars, and that they made him scale back the information that he could have given that would have been damaging to the Zimmerman in the murder of Trayvon Martin. So he was talking so much about it that I believe he had to stop talking so much about it, because he was implying that he himself was a co-conspirator and a criminal decision to not indict, to not win a conviction against Zimmerman. So he scaled back, I thought. But what he did was he scaled back and he wrote a book. So now he has a book about how they didn't want him to give full, complete, and truthful information. In other words, that's what you say when you're going on the witness stand. You know, I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. He is more or less admitting that as the medical examiner, his testimony should not be trusted. So that is one medical examiner who admitted that his examination and the information that he gave the jury should not have been trusted, because he could have said more. He left out information because the lawyers, even the prosecutor, wanted him to. And so, number two, I want to tell you about Dr. O.C. Smith. That's O.C. Smith. Dr. Smith came as close as he could to admitting that he lied in a capital murder case. He was the medical examiner in Memphis, Tennessee. He was the medical examiner who gave very damning testimony in the trial of Mr. Phillips. I have to look up his name. But this guy was, he got executed. The medical examiner, as it came close to the date for this guy's execution, because, you know, they keep him on death row for years. I think the man had been on death row for a number of years. He had a situation where all of the witnesses against him withdrew their testimony, just like for Troy Davis. They withdrew their testimony. But that wasn't good enough to get him off death row, because they had a medical examiner to say that the trajectory of the bullet, that means the direction from which the bullet came, could only have come from his gun. Well, this man had sworn all these years that he was on death row that it was another policeman that shot the policeman that he was on death row for shooting. He had robbed the Wendy's, and he admitted he had robbed the Wendy's, and he had run from the Wendy's. And the police started chasing him. And it was said that he turned his gun on the police, but he denied that. One of the policemen, there was two policemen chasing him. One of them died. One of them got shot and died. And so they put that death on him, because he's the one who had robbed the Wendy's and was running from the police. He said he saw the other police shoot this guy. But the medical examiner said from the direction that the bullet came, it could only have come from this robber. Well, who's going to believe a robber over the word of a medical examiner?
Yeah.
Years later, when it was time for this guy to get executed, the medical examiner had an attack of conscience, and he kidnapped himself. He wrapped himself in duct tape. He secured dynamite to his body. He put barbed wire around his head, and he locked himself in the stairwell there at the medical examiner's office in Memphis, Tennessee. He put notes on himself, and the notes said, "Dr. Smith lied about the bullet trajectory." Now, I think that the reason he did that is he was hoping that he would throw doubt on whether this man was innocent or not. He wanted them to look at that case again, but he didn't want to just admit that he lied. So he staged this big kidnapping and put the notes on himself saying that he lied. He was trying to not be a party to a wrongful execution. That's what I think he was trying to do. But at the same time, he didn't want to admit that he lied about the direction of the bullets. He lied because he was helping the police get off the hook. And that's something very common for medical examiners. In Memphis, the medical examiner's office is a county office. It's the Shelby County Medical Examiner. And so are the police. The police work for the same entity. You know, they are Shelby County Police. There are Memphis City Police. They all work together. And when one of them screws up, the others cover their backs. And so this medical examiner had lied about the direction of the bullet to put it on this robber, but he had an attack of conscience when the robber was about to be executed, and he tried to take it back. And he even put notes on himself saying that he lied about the trajectory of the bullet. And so what they did was they gave this man another hearing. But even at the hearing, you had two or three Republican judges that came out of retirement to swing the vote against him. And they did execute him, even though the medical examiner had tried to take back what he said. And so those are two examples where medical examiners have outright more or less admitted that they lie to help police. Both of those. Also, I want you to know that forensic labs, you know, a lot of people believe whatever forensic labs say. If they say to people, oh, yes, his DNA was at the scene, they believe that, and they will send someone to the electric chair, to the lethal injection table. They'll hang someone off the word of forensic labs. But I want you to look at my articles, just put in Mary Neal Forensic Labs, because they have caught forensic laboratories skewing the results in thousands, not one or two cases, thousands of cases in order to work with the prosecutors to get convictions. So, yes, forensic labs lie. Medical examiners lie. Now, let me give you another example of an unjust medical examination. In Georgia last year, I think it was last year, we had a high school student, last name Johnson, to go to school and not come home. His parents put in a missing person report.
Hello?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I tell you, the stalkers cut me off. I must have been making some good points about these medical examiners who are sometimes liars. I don't know at what point they cut me off. I told you about three medical examiners, and that was the medical examiner for Trayvon Martin, who admitted after they fired him that he had not given complete information regarding his medical examination of the body of Trayvon Martin. He even wrote a book about it. And the second medical examiner that I discussed was O.C. Smith in Memphis, Tennessee, who may be responsible for a wrongful execution. According to the man who was executed for a murder,
The man said that he didn't shoot the police officer. Another policeman did. And this was Mr. Phillips. I'll look up his name for you. Phillip may have been his first name or his last name. But in any case, it could have been Philip Wood. He may have been executed in 2007. Medical examiner kidnapped himself and put notes on himself admitting or accusing himself of having lied about the bullet trajectory. He said that from the bullet trajectory, it came from the direction that only this man could have shot the police officer. I figured that a few years later, when it was time to execute this man, O.C. Smith had an attack of conscience, and he kidnapped himself. He wrapped himself in duct tape. He put barbed wire on his head, and he stuck notes on his person saying, Dr. Smith lied about the bullet trajectory in the Philip Wood case. But what happened is the witnesses for the prosecution had already recanted their stories. And so now you got the medical examiner calling his own examination of the scene into question. I think he was hoping that would be enough for reasonable doubt, so he wouldn't be a party to a wrongful execution. But he was wrong, because two Republican judges came out of retirement in Tennessee, and they decided to execute this guy anyway, even though he might have been innocent. In fact, I think he was innocent. Even the man, the police officer who was killed, even his own daughter believed this man who was being executed for killing her father. It turned out, years later, when I met a person who worked with Memphis police at the time, it turned out that this officer who was killed was hated by the other police officers because he had crossed the picket line. So understand that he was hated by other police officers. In fact, they had had him working on jail duty for a period of time after the end of the strike because they feared for his safety. And this was the first week that he was back on the street working as a police officer that he came up dead. Now, I believe that he was killed by another police officer, just like this guy who was executed for his murder. Three, another medical examiner to be concerned about is whoever examined the body of Johnson, last name Johnson, a teenager in Georgia, who his parents had his body exhumed, and they did an independent autopsy and found out that their baby was stuffed with newspapers. How come that didn't come out in the first autopsy, the one that the county did? Didn't that man who or woman who did the first autopsy see that the body was stuffed with newspapers? Wasn't it on the report someplace? I can't examine the heart. The heart is not present. I can't examine the lungs. The lungs are not present. I can't examine the kidneys. The kidneys are not present. I think it was a false autopsy that the county or city rendered, because why would the doctor ignore the fact that this person is laying here with no organs? Why were all the organs removed? Or is he the one who removed the organs? So these are situations, and that's just a few. There have been many fake autopsy reports, many fake ones. And now we come down to Michael Brown's autopsy, where a medical examiner has said that all the bullets entered Michael Brown from the front. And so I say to you, that could or could not be true, because medical examiners are as capable of lying as anybody else. Even forensic labs lie. Just last year, a forensic lab was called into question about not just 10 or 20, but thousands and thousands, over 100,000 cases, because it was discovered that one of the forensic scientists was working with prosecutors to help them win convictions. So, you know, the thing is that we believe any damn thing they tell us about DNA. Oh, the DNA at the scene belonged to her, so she sure is the murderer. And the forensics lab could be lying. Another forensics examiner in that same lab did not really have the minimum qualifications to be a forensics examiner. Yes, this person had lied on their credentials. They had lied on their resume. So they're there with people's lives in their hands, determining who goes to jail and who goes to the death chamber. And they're not even qualified to handle the examinations that are entrusted to them regarding matching blood with the scene and regarding matching hair samples with the rug. They weren't qualified. And their qualifications had never been checked. And so they weren't even qualified to be a medical examiner. I mean, not a medical examiner, but a forensic laboratory worker. So you had in one lab, you had one forensic laboratory technician who was working with the prosecutors to help them win wrongful convictions. And you had another forensic laboratory worker in the same lab who was not qualified for her job. Please stop listening to things that people say and taking it as truth. Jesus is the only man who never lied. Medical examiners lie all the damn time, just like police do. They all get paid out of the same payroll, and they will lie for police. They will lie for them. They have done it in the past. You can lie through omission and commission. Now, Michael Brown was murdered, and whether or not the bullets in it from the front or from the back or from the top of the head is irrelevant. Those bullets came from that officer's gun, and that young man had had no trial and no jury. And all he could have been charged with, Sir New, was jaywalking. And jaywalking is a misdemeanor. So that's not a capital offense. So the man was murdered. So let's not fall into arguing about which way the bullets came from. Whichever way they came from, the officer Wilson, I think his name is, killed him. And he did it illegally. Nobody appointed him to be somebody's executioner that day. He killed the boy, and he shot him. And witnesses say that he shot him while he was chasing him. So whether the bullets hit the boy in the front or the back is not determined as far as I know. Even though a medical examiner said they hit the boy from the front, I say it's not determined because I know what damn liars medical examiners have been in the past and can be today. So, I've seen children playing, and I had a nephew. He would run straight, he would be running hard as he could straight ahead, and he run into a telephone pole because while he was running forward, he got his body turned around looking backward. I imagine if you're running from an officer who's shooting at you, that might be the way you'd run. So even though the witness said the man shot the boy as the boy was running away, he still could have shot him in such a way that the bullets entered the front because the boy could be running like my nephew used to run, running forward with half his body from his waist up turned backwards, looking at what he's running from. So just be careful how you make assumptions from the evidence that's being fed to you. These people have a way of feeding you propaganda to make you believe what they want you to. Just hold on to the bottom line, and that is that Michael Brown had done no capital offense, and he was executed. Simple as that. They want to make us focus on Michael Brown had been to the store and stolen cigarettes. Well, we didn't follow him with the camera the whole time he was in the store. The camera was jumping. I heard he paid for the cigarettes, but even if he did steal them, that's not a capital offense either. So, Michael Brown was murdered, simple as that, and we will hold on to that. They even said he had marijuana in the system. Show me a Caucasian boy of 19 years old who doesn't have marijuana in his system. All kids do marijuana, most of them, at some point, even your ex-president Clinton. Thank you. And Obama did cocaine. So how is that something to say? He should have been dead because he had marijuana. See, what they don't tell you when they're releasing this information about he had marijuana in his system and he had just taken cigars from a store and the bullets entered from the front. All of that is to back up the lie that he deserved to die. And none of it is true. You have some dope smokers right in Congress. You have some dope smokers working with you every day. In fact, we know from their report, if we want to believe it, what Michael Brown had in his system, but we don't know what that officer had in his system. Why is that? Because police officers don't have to do a drug test. Even after they kill somebody, they don't test them for steroids, which we know causes people to be aggressive. They don't test them for alcohol, which I have a video of an officer as drunk as a dog stopping somebody for a ticket and threatening them. Drunk as a dog. The man fell because he was so drunk. And they don't test them to see if they're drunk when they kill somebody. They don't test them for cocaine usage or heroin usage or marijuana usage. So you know what Micah Brown had in him, but you don't know what Officer Wilson, I think that's his name, you don't know what he had in him because he didn't have to take a drug test. He didn't have to take an alcohol test. All he had to do is go home and enjoy his fat vacation check coming from taxpayers' money. That's it. So don't tell me about Micah Brown had marijuana in him. If you get 100 teenagers together and line them up, at least half of them will probably have test positive for marijuana. Because for one thing, marijuana is, they didn't tell you this, but marijuana is something that stays in your system for up to 3 months. Micah Brown could have smoked marijuana 3 months ago, and it still would have shown up that he had marijuana in his system. So understand that. And understand that medical examiners lie for police. Yes, they do. Also understand that medical examiners some of them have confessed to skewing the results of their examination in favor of police. They have confessed to doing that, some of them. So just be aware of these things. Be aware of that forensics lab. If you're ever called to a jury and they want to make you be absolutely convinced that somebody is guilty because the forensics examination says so, be aware that at one point they had to close down the forensics laboratory in Detroit, Michigan, because it was so sloppy and it was giving errors. It was giving errors. Okay, it was so sloppily, the tests that they do were just so sloppy that, no good record keeping, no, probably nothing clean in there to do examinations with, because they're dealing with very small microscopic evidence sometimes. And the laboratory was so unreliable, they had to close it down. And I want you to know, Detroit, that I'm very glad that you did that. You closed down that forensics lab so that you could give it a redo. You didn't try to hide the fact that a forensic lab was putting out errors. You didn't try to hide it. And so you got others in other cities that do try to hide the problems that they have. And so you can't trust forensic laboratories. If they come back and tell you that, oh, yes, the DNA matches the evidence at the scene, for most of us, we say, oh, well, it's a done deal. But we have enough evidence of forensic labs, number one, working with prosecutors to come up with these skewed results, and number two, being unable, educationally unable, to perform the tests that they are paid to perform. And number three, we have evidence that one lab was closed down because it was impossible to trust the readings from that lab because it was so sloppy. So you can't trust the forensic evidence. You can't. And you can't trust medical examiners. Think about the Johnson family. They'd already done an autopsy on their son. The city or county had, according to my understanding, and they had buried the boy. And when the parents got the money together to get an independent autopsy and had that boy exhumed, he was full of newspaper. Why would that not come out in the original autopsy? Why wouldn't it? Who moved the organs from Johnson? Little Mr. Johnson from Georgia. Who did that? So please, 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 I want you to know that these police officers, a lot of them, are murderers, and most of the rest of them are cover-up artists. I said most of. And in case any of you are not cover-up artists, if any of you are getting offended and you are not a cover-up artist, then please call my number, 678-531-0262, and tell me what happened to Larry Neal, Memphis, Tennessee police. So, many of them are murderers, and most of the rest of them are cover-up artists. And you can't believe anything any of them say. You just go with what you know. And that is that Officer Wilson chased that boy down and shot it. And it is possible for someone to be running forward with his body turned from his waist up, looking back at who's shooting at him. That is entirely possible. So thank you very much for coming to Human Rights Demand today. COINTELPRO cut me off when I was talking about these medical examiners and these forensic labs and these prosecutors working together against truth and justice. So I thank you very much for doing that. You gave me something to do today. I'll write an article about these lying medical examiners. Think about the Trayvon Martin case. That man even wrote a book about his testimony at the Trayvon Martin trial because he said he wasn't allowed to give the full story that he could have from his examination. They didn't want it. Guess who didn't want it? The prosecutors didn't want it. The ones who were supposed to be prosecuting Zimmerman, they didn't want the truth told by the medical examiner. So God bless y'all. Have a nice day. I've got some writing to do. I think I'll name this article False Medical Examinations. False Medical Examinations. I think I'll name it that. I may name it something else because really we got a lot of false scientific evidence in a lot of cases, not just medical examinations. False evidence appearing real. God bless you. Have a nice day.